Good morning. Thank you for waiting. We want to call the Customer Service and Operations meeting to order. Are the agendas before you, are there any concerns about the agenda? Any objections? The agenda is accepted as provided. And the approval of the minutes. Is there a motion for approval of the minutes? Mr. Bolger moves, approve a second. Second, Mr. Downey. Questions? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Oppose. Thank you very much. This morning we are going to start with the action item, but before beginning, I want to inform you that the Chief Performance Officer, Andrea Burns, will go through the vital signs report and focusing on the 10 performance indicators and our progress this second quarter. And additionally, we will have a information item on the new electronic payment program, which Mr. Tom Randall will present. But we'll start now with the item for action, which is to seek our approval for the final component of the Title VI program, the Public Participation Plan. This item was brought before the board, I think, in January, and it was in preparation of the plan. And additionally, we have had several approvals for the Title VI program. It includes our service standards, definitions of major service changes, disparate impact, disproportionate burden, as well as equity analysis of bus service. This participation plan is a very, I think, important plan that I think will probably, when implemented into the system, provide a great deal of the kind of customer service work that we've been talking about over quite a few times. It's an opportunity for outreach and strategies and procedures and tools and processes that all of the organization will be able to have. So we'll start with Mr. Nguyen and Ms. Barasak. Are you going to get started?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and good morning to everyone.
Morning.
So we're very excited to present what I think is the final piece for your consideration from the Title VI circular requirements, and this is the Public Participation Plan. As you know, we've been out campaigning, taking the pulse of our customers and the riding public and the non-riding public for more than a year, trying to learn better about how to communicate with people, how to get their input and their thoughts about service and policy changes, and trying to have more of a conversation with people, trying to figure out what kinds of communications channels work best in collecting the most vast set of opinions that we can. In this region, as you know, we serve a very large and highly diverse set of communities. In fact, the majority of our service area is made up of minorities, and 8% of our population in the region are low income. That's important to know in terms of census data, because when we first look at who we need to include in our public participation plan, often the communities that we want to participate are harder to reach through some of the more traditional public engagement means. When you consider that almost 12% of a regional population does not speak, read, or write English well, that adds to the challenge. Limited English proficiency is one of the barriers to getting good public input into our process. And so we have gone to a plan that tries to articulate all service information in at least the top five languages that are spoken in the region, which includes Spanish, Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese, and several different African languages, depending on the community. Our customers reflect the profile of the region, and in fact, our customer base is also very diverse. Our overall system demographics are that 56% of our riders are minorities, and about three times the number of people, as you see in the region, are low income, roughly 24%. So again, we have a higher percentage of low income folks making up our riding public, and it's particularly important that this plan address ways to engage that population. The demographics vary by mode, and I will tell you that the most diverse population will be found on Metro Bus. So when we talk about the goals for our plan, they were certainly to be inclusive, collaborative, responsive, and consistent. At the end of the day, what we sought to achieve was to create a systemic plan that provides a consistent approach to our public outreach for all major service and policy issues as defined by the board. And we wanted to ensure a deep level of engagement that was inclusive of all communities. As you know, historically, this has been a rather tailored approach, ad hoc, if you will, for each initiative. We have gone out and defined it each time in a different way. So we did one set of activities if it was a budget matter. We did another set of activities if it was bus service planning. This will create a manual and a game plan for public engagement for all those major service initiatives so that it's consistent and it's done right and it reaches all the communities with all of the new channels of communication that we've identified here. So what triggers the plan? Well, we've already been living it in some ways, and so these triggers will be familiar. We've had some high-profile service and policy changes just this year, and we've been learning from the customers as we go and have tried to employ some of the outreach in the initiatives, including for the Silver Line, where we did probably one of the two most vast public engagement collection sets that we've done. The other was for Momentum. And we have thought about the future kinds of engagements that we will likely be part of. Triggers will be things like planning projects, long-range strategic planning, such as Momentum, Metro 2025, those kinds of initiatives. Amenities and infrastructure. As you know, we've gotten rider feedback about our fare gates, about fare media types, as we talked today about the new fare payment program, and you'll hear more about that. The environmental analyses that we do if we're going to, for example, construct a new bus maintenance facility. We, of course, look at the environmental justice impact of that plan. For service changes, including routes or frequency of Metro bus or Metro rail lines. Public information campaigns, if we're going to need to shut down a station for a period of time for maintenance or repairs, that would be a trigger. And, of course, policy alternatives, budget changes, fare changes, things that the board might contemplate as a policy matter would all be triggers for this public participation plan. The process that we've used is outlined on the next slide. And I will just say that basically what we did is we took the federal requirements in the Title VI circular, as Jim's group defined for us, and we said, let's use this as an opportunity for broad engagement. And so we used that Title VI circular as sort of a foundation and then built on it. I think what we've done exceeds what the Title VI circular requires for us, expands on what we think is a really good idea. And it joins and marries together with the general manager's plan that we started a couple years ago around the customer service action initiatives, which said we want to have a two-way dialogue with our customers, not just one way. And so how do we use this opportunity with this new program to supplement the efforts that we've already been engaged in? Effective October 1, 2012, the FTA revised its Title VI regulation in the circular that I mentioned. And, excuse me, it is required for all transit agencies around the country. For that reason, and to learn best practices, as part of this process, we didn't just talk to our riders. We interviewed 10 peer agencies in similar size and demographic diversity about their public engagement practices, and some of those included BART, Chicago Transit Authority, Puget Sound Regional Transit Authority, DDOT, New York City Transit, TriMet, the Metropolitan Council of Minneapolis-St. Paul, LA Metro, SEPTA, and Miami-Dade. We also, as part of this process, met with more than 60 Metro staff and four of the board members who engaged with customers in one way or another to learn what has been working and what their suggestions were. We also had a dialogue with more than 200 community-based organizations and asked them to fill out a questionnaire about their relationships with Metro and then again how they communicate with the clients that they serve. And we had nearly half of those community-based organizations respond in writing and then another 20% who had meetings with us and talked us through those questions. And a very important part of this was also 23 public events that were held around the region through our Speak Up campaign, collecting information about how to reach folks, and that, in fact, engaged us with 3,500 of our customers via surveys that were administered in 7 languages. So what were the key findings of all this outreach? And I know that's a question that Mr. Bulger had asked me very early on. Well, my headline for this committee is that public hearings are a thing of the past as far as our customers are concerned. They do not want to be told that there is a 2-hour block of time in some transit-friendly location where they can come and provide their thoughts. They want us to come to them. They want us to come to their bus stop, to their grocery store, to their house of worship. They want us to come and ask them in their own language, through surveys and in person, what they think and what they prefer. And so we have heard that, we've understood it, and that is very much at the center of this plan going forward. We will tailor the strategies that we use to communicate with these communities based on what the communities have told us. And importantly, they also said, you need to show me that you're listening and provide feedback at the end of your process about what you heard and what you did about it. And so closing that loop and sort of being able to feed back to people, we heard you, here's what we've done differently, that's the end of the communication. So collecting the information is just the beginning, and we get that, and that's part of the plan too. Folks also told us that they want us to offer alternatives to online outreach for low-income and limited English proficiency groups. We talk about the unbanked in my group. We talk about the unwired. So if you're not a person who's online frequently or you're not a person who goes purposefully onto the Internet to do surveys, you want some other form of outreach that doesn't require you to be plugged in somewhere. Again, in person, in community is best. Use cultural and language-appropriate media to reach diverse groups, and develop organizational relationships is really important, whether it's the Paralyzed Veterans of America or CASA de Maryland. We can reach their constituents through their organizations and often have much more credibility and validity going in, having done those partnerships. And so the maintenance of those relationships will be very important to us for many reasons, including the public participation plan going forward. We also learned that when it comes to limited English proficiency, it's not sufficient just to communicate in other languages. Folks think that we use too many words here at Metro to communicate, that our narratives are long and sometimes, and I know you'll be surprised to hear this, a little bit wonky. So they've asked us to think even more simply about how we share ideas. And for those who are limited proficient in English, as well as for visitors from around the world, they've said try to use those icons that other transportation carriers are starting to use. Use graphic symbols to communicate with us and fewer words. Even for those who have English as a first language, that's a faster way to understand a concept and to learn. And in the fast-paced region that we live in, with all of the competition of information and news, we are going to try very, very thoughtfully to go to a more graphics-based approach and to use fewer words in what we do. You can appreciate that challenge when you think about the bus service changes that we're currently going out and asking the public about. We really need the public to understand the bus starts here, it ends here, and here are the ways that's going to change. Doing that graphically is quite a challenge for us, but we're up to it. Customer preferences as to how they receive information, it won't surprise you. Our customers consume media like the region does. So we asked them which TV stations they watch. They pretty much tracked with the way TV stations are rated in this region. We asked them what they read. They told us they read the Post and then they read community newspapers. For those who are online, they told us which online publications they look at. And the more special interest and the more local those are, the more likely they are to pay attention. But what they said to us is the number one way for you to talk to us is while we're on your system. And we've heard this before. You know, when we were doing the map update, that folks said that to us. The most, and when we've talked about incident communications, folks say this to us. When we're on the system, you have us captive to talk to us on buses and on trains. And you should hand us materials at that time with very few words on them. But make sure that as we come through, that's where you're catching us and asking us for our opinion. And so those intercept surveys that we do, very, very important, and we do those in multiple languages, using a multitude of staff that we have here, including our police department, where, you know, we will find an officer who speaks Vietnamese, and that officer will be used to support customer information for a day. So we appreciate the sort of all-in customer outreach support that we get from the rest of the organization. We also learned that some of the preferences that our customers have and the public has as to how they receive information are about generation, not about language. And so you might not be surprised to know that if you want to reach young people ages 18 to 24, you can probably do that using Facebook and Twitter. If you want to reach people over 55, that is not the preferred mechanism. So being especially attentive, even those over 55 who are online, they prefer email and listservs that they're already consuming, and they want you to piggyback on those rather than driving them to another kind of site, a community bulletin board, or a chat room where they're not familiar or wouldn't be comfortable. And so going forward, it's important to know how we're going to engage. We have a manual. We call it a toolkit. It'll be on our intranet site. We're briefing our departments on it next week. Essentially, my department will become one-stop shopping for public outreach and engagement, collaborating with Jim's group, who will be continuing to make sure that we're compliant with Title VI, as well as that we've checked in with all the community-based organizations in a systemic way. There is cultural and language-appropriate media, which we're expanding on. Again, I say we've already done some of this for Momentum and for Silverline. We're going to be doing more of it. You'll see us proactively reaching out more with our new partners at Univision and Telemundo. We've already been advertising in the Epoch Times, the Korean Times, but you'll see more of that, both in terms of telling our story through their news media, translating press releases, that kind of thing, as well as through paid advertising. non-traditional methods. Again, with Silverline, we've been out at festivals. We're at the Del Rey Farmers Market. We're at community meetings. We're at PG Plaza for shoppers. And we'll be doing more and more of that to be present in communities and highly visible in communities where people will see us as a part of the fabric of the community. Measures to track success. Obviously, when we come back to the board, each time we have a change that's being proposed to you or you're being informed about, we are going to go back through Jim's organization, through planning. We're going to show you how we've put together the public participation plan, what the results were for that initiative, what the community said to us, and, of course, that will be incorporated into the Title VI analysis that ultimately is shared with you to determine disproportionate impacts. The staffing plan, it's going to be accomplished within the existing budget parameters that we have for the operating budget. Essentially, I am taking a vacancy and converting it to have a public participation manager. And over time, we'll hire outreach specialists who will facilitate this. So whether you're in the capital program area and you're the one putting together the proposed bus maintenance facility, or if you're in bus service planning and you're proposing route changes, or if you're in rail and you're proposing a new rail station, you will come to these folks. They will work with EEO, determine the demographics of the communities where these impacts will be, and then put together the communications outreach plan based on those diverse communities to make sure that we reach everybody and then pull the information together to develop the analysis. The plan will start to be implemented in January, which is when we think we'll have all of our organizational changes done. It will be posted. The entire plan is available for you to review on your diligent book, the executive summary available on our website. The entire plan itself is hundreds of pages. Ultimately, once approved by the board, we'll make that available to the public. It's, as a practical matter, it's not a very user-friendly document. Ultimately, the toolkit that we have internally will be a much more sort of how-to document, but the board is asked to consider for approval the full plan, and to approve that so that we can submit it to the FTA next month. With that, I will answer happily any questions that you have, or my colleague Jim Nguyen can also answer questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bowersock. This idea of showing up at a public hearing and watching five people listen to you is far gone. And it really is a very important process in that we actually know our customers, we recognize who they are, we understand how they want information, and we're willing to really reach out to them. And I think, so importantly, partnering with those community-based organizations, we need to go where the people are and understand the importance of their own community in doing so, and recognize that diversity, but also that we understand them and are willing to make that step. And so I think that's going to be tremendous, as well as the opportunity that the entire organization is training in order to get the opportunity to do the same in each way with a toolkit in an effective way. So let me open it up for questions, Mr. Bolger.
Lynn and Madam Chair, thank you. Fellow board members, this is a really important action that we're about to embark on, and just wanted to call that to your attention. We spent a lot of time on this with the Chair. And Lynn, I think it's in really good shape, but I just want to make sure that this is like a living document, though, the toolkit, and, you know, how we continually maintain relationships with the community-based organizations now and in the future is critical, I think. And I just would hope that enrich all the momentum supporters that we have generated over the last year or so, which is the business community, institutional community. I hope that that gets also folded in, because I think that's a balance between the community-based organizations and the, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, the Board of Trade, et cetera, et cetera. So I look forward to supporting this, Madam Chair, and seeing regular updates. And I wish we could start with the public hearing that I have to chair in October. As we mentioned in our pre-conference, I would agree, as the chair pointed out, that the public hearing process, and I'm looking at the press over there, is, you know, it's hard to get a pulse of the community when the same people show up for the two-hour slot or schedule. And I think if we had all of this in motion sooner rather than later, I think we'd get different results in the public hearings, perhaps. But thank you. Congratulations. Great job.
Ms. Hines and Mr. Downey, Ms. Porter.
Let me echo Tom's praise for the work that you've done. I think it's been really, you've done a great scan of the region and thought through all the various strategies. And, of course, as you say, we've been experimenting for the last several years. To me, one of the most important shifts here is putting yourself in relationship with all these community-based organizations. That's really, I think, going to be critical to our success. And I was looking at the performance measures and noticed that the way you plan to get information back from the CBOs, community-based organizations, is basically a survey. And let me just urge you a little bit to include and potentially put this into the report, some kind of maybe every two-year focus conversation. You won't hit all these groups in any one year. We're in a particularly rich time in terms of how, you know, the amount of work that's going on around our stuff. But I do think there's a lot of turnover in these organizations, and how you refresh those relationships moving forward is going to be critical. And sometimes the face-to-face is a lot easier than a survey that comes in and, you know, some intern is the person who ends up filling it out because the exec doesn't know anything. So I just encourage you to put a little bit more, there's a lot of richness here, but I think to maintain those relationships, we have to do more than just a survey.
And Ms. Hines, that's very appropriate to the piece that you saw that was under my organization. I have a body who has that responsibility, because we do realize that our CBOs want to see us more than just when we want something from them. They want to see us to just interact and talk and discuss different aspects in Metro and in their constituencies.
That is just terrific. I'm really glad to hear that. The other reason I bring it up is I do think that there's a lot here that our jurisdictions could use and key off of to improve our processes. You've done a really great job, and so, you know, anything that can kind of enhance that conversation about the richness in the plan translates back into messaging to others who might look at the plan.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. I think it's important, Ms. Bioshock, you mentioned how many agencies you went out to, but I think what we learned that this plan is unique in the sense that they are not doing all of these things at this time. Is that correct?
I think it's fair to say that we've exceeded the requirements, mm-hmm. and this is a very,
oh, yes, very,
it's a very robust plan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Down.
Yeah. Thank you for briefing us on this and for the material. I didn't get all the way through the report, but I learned a lot of things about this region mm-hmm. and how it works that I did not know before. I think will be very helpful. I really see this, importantly, as going well beyond compliance to setting a standard of what we should be doing, building a relationship with the people who use our system, the people who pay for our system. I look forward to that. On one of the slides, you talked about what will trigger the PPP and a lot of different things that might do that. Will it be a process in order, the big cookbook, but what is the recipe for the particular thing you want to do? Will it be a kind of a checkpoint in the planning of a new project or in service changes or the like to say what elements of the PPP are we going to use this time? And then as a board, when will we be advised and in fact we're in that kind of a process and should be expecting that kind of a result?
I'll start and Jim can add. In going back to the departments now, we are doing budget and business planning for the coming year. And so our initiative is to identify all of those trigger projects mm-hmm. or trigger proposals right. that would be part of the general manager's upcoming budget and business plan. And by analyzing those and seeing which of those rise to the level of a trigger, we'll be able to plan the outreach in advance.
But the trigger wouldn't set off the same full process for each of them, wouldn't it be
yes.
a kind of a tailored process for what?
It's tailored to the extent that it is specific to the demographic
yeah.
profile of the community.
Mm-hmm.
So if that community, if it's a very narrow impact
yeah.
and that community is primarily English and Korean speaking, I wouldn't be doing a Spanish version
right.
of the materials. But
things that affect the whole region and the whole system, we would go
that's
kind
right.
of the full.
It would be full court press
okay.
for any of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the other thing that could happen, though, is an unplanned, unscheduled policy discussion or service matter that would trigger this. And at that point, again, the executive leadership team would be responsible for identifying with Jim that it constitutes a trigger as defined and then employing the manual
yeah.
to develop the plan.
And as you go through this process, at some point there will be then a report back to us, as there now is in a very standardized fashion on the public hearing, but this will be a much richer,
richer
piece
report,
that
yeah.
says here's what we've learned and here's what you should know before you make the decision you have to make.
That's correct.
Good.
Ms. Porter.
Thank you. I think this has been a tremendous job in pulling all this together, and I really think you've done fine work here. I also think that we've greatly, greatly improved our public communication in the last few years, starting from not such an auspicious start, but we're doing much, much better now. One of the differences between sort of the old media and the new media is the old media is sort of based on getting information out there. New media is interactive. And I think the expectations people have out there for this kind of communication is that it will be two-way. You mentioned in your presentation that customers want to know what we've done with what they've told us. And I think that's the critical thing. If we are really good at putting information out there, but people don't think we pay any attention to their response, we really won't have that much of an impact. So, and I'm saying this not to you, but to sort of all of us. But if people don't get the sense that we care what they think and we, more importantly, do something with what they tell us, that I think that we won't have been as effective as we can be. And it's also a resource. I mean, getting this information out here is, you know, something that we need to do for various reasons, but it's also good for our organization. But there is a resource out there in terms of what the public knows and what they think and what they want, that if we can capture it, it could be a tremendous resource for us in the planning that we do. So I hope we don't waste that and we don't give people the impression that we aren't paying attention to what they tell us. So very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Ms. Marisak and Mr. Nguyen, thank you very much. A very effective plan, and I think it's an opportunity for us to really have our customers get to know who we are as an organization and how we serve them best by that communication. This is a recommendation for approval at the board meeting. Is there action? Yes, thank you. Mr. Boger moves approval. Is there a second? Second by Mr. Dyke. Questions? Hearing none. All those in favor of recommendation and opposed? Thank you very much. We look forward to you coming back to us. The next item is Burnside is going to go through the vital signs report, quarterly report, and give us where we stand on our key performance indicators.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
This is our second vital signs report for the calendar year 2014, and I'm going to cover the months of April, May, and June, and the results that I'll be talking about is an average of those 3 months. For our 10 key performance indicators as compared to the same time period last year in 2013. So as the title says, our measures showed mixed results. The good news is that mixed results are more on the positive side, so 7 of the 10 measures improved, and I'm going to be talking a little bit more about each of those areas as we go through the next couple slides, starting with bus. Next slide, please. Our better bus service improvements are starting to deliver on the promise. On-time performance is up 2 percentage points from the same time period last year, approaching 78%. And we've seen most notably an improvement in the number of reduction of buses that are running late during the quarter. We have an initiative which is called Active Service Management, and what that does is reposition our bus service managers. Those are the folks on the front lines managing the bus service to be out on the streets and on board the buses and out of their cars, and that's showing some improvement. One of the mantras coming out of bus leadership is predictive, proactive, and reactive when addressing service challenges. And an example of this would be improving our street operations guidelines so we better deploy our strategic buses, and those are buses that are reserved to maintain quality service to keep us on time. We also have a number of efficiency studies underway for some of our most heaviest used lines in the region. Now, on-time performance is showing improvement even in the face of some fleet challenges during the quarter. All of our bus fleets have shown a variety of mechanical troubles this year, and as a result, we're not currently meeting our reliability target. Severe weather and roadway conditions during the quarter contributed to some mechanical issues, and everyone's thinking right now, well, we've had a very mild summer, but remember, we're talking about the spring. And we actually had some record rains during May, which is kind of the middle of the reporting period. We had mechanical failures affecting each fleet type. One particular issue has been water intrusion, and this has a direct impact on electrical components, which causes our engines to cut off. The sensitive electronic and mechanical systems of our modern transit buses haven't really been standing up to some of our weather extremes. So we're working on engineering solutions in cooperation with the bus manufacturers and doing repairs. Already they're underway under warranty, and that saves us a lot of money. We're installing what's known as diversion shields on our CNG fleets to help avoid water intrusion. And, of course, continued steady investment in replacement buses and to maintain our average fleet age and continuing to invest in midlife overhauls is going to have an ultimate long-term impact on the fleet challenges. Okay, moving to rail. Rail on-time performance has been better this quarter than target this quarter, but it's slightly below the on-time performance of last year. The red line was most notably challenged during the quarter with some of our rush service levels disrupted by a number of big events. In June, PM rush OT, on-time performance fell below 80% on one day each week with multiple causes, including a person struck by a train, arcing insulator, brake problems, and a track interlocking going out of service. I will say that as you look forward to July, and that's not the report period I'm reporting right now, but we have seen a significant improvement on the red line, which has gone up to 92.4%. Regular cross-departmental meetings are reviewing weekly rail performance and some of the significant incidents that impact customers and cause delay. And that improves the coordination amongst the different departments and rail so that we can continue to help reduce those delays and look at all the minutes involved in the delays and continue to drive those down. We're also working to deliver long-term improvements, and those have temporarily impacted the red line weekday evening track work, but other non-core evening track work has been scheduled on other parts of the railroad so as not to degrade our on-time performance across all the lines. A lot of preparation work was done during this particular quarter to get ready for the Silver Line, which opened in July. Metrorail fleet reliability has been a critical aspect of this preparation work, and for two out of the 3 months of the quarter, the results were better than target and better than last year. Our overall fleet requirements as the Silver Line opened increased 5% to 954 cars in service, even though the total fleet size is currently unchanged. We have had challenges to meet this target due to poor performance of the 4000 series fleet, which chronically underperforms all the other types of fleet. These cars experienced 42% worse reliability this quarter compared to the same time last year, and we're working on a number of different campaigns on this and other fleets to try to keep that reliability up. Vertical transportation. This is a really good news story. Both elements of our vertical transportation system, escalators and elevators, are beating their performance targets and outperforming the results from the same time last year. Escalator availability ran about 92 to 93% for the 3 months, and elevators did even better, beating our 97% availability for each month of the quarter. The success here is from a combination of prior investment and resource increases, as well as our engaged management, prioritizing a better trained workforce. As I've talked to you before, the workforce is being deployed by sectors, and that helps the folks maintaining these units have a more manageable service area and also just to become more familiar with the units that they're working on. It also helps with some internal competition. And this is where I want to bring your attention to a very impressive submeasure that management tracks supporting our overall KPI of availability, and that's the average time that it takes to repair a broken escalator and get it back in service, and that's improved from 17 hours in 2011 to only 5 hours this quarter. So we've really driven that time down. Okay, safety and security. Our customer injury rate has improved more than 17% during the quarter compared to last year. This improvement is tied to a significant decline in bus customer injuries, which typically make up all of our injuries. So whenever we can drive down bus accidents, it has an impact both on customer injuries as well as employee injuries. Our bus managers have aggressively pursued a number of initiatives to deliver this result. We have accident investigation teams scoring accident severity and identifying corrective actions. Operators are being sent to remedial training based upon the results of reviewing drive cam data. Drive cam are the little cameras on the front of the buses that are activated when there is any particular G-forces. All operators are now subject to mandatory refresher training, and that's all operators, not just those having challenges. And a new tool is being deployed to ensure consistency and compliance with training and training period guidelines. Our employee injury is also better than target and better than the same time last year. There were 40 fewer employees injured during the quarter. We've had continuing communication efforts with employees to reinforce the need about not to become complacent and to promote the culture of safety that we've been working on for a number of years now. Chief Pavlik, moving to security, Chief Pavlik is going to be talking to you about that in a couple of weeks, but you've all seen the headlines, so I'll just briefly say that serious crime on Metro has dropped to a five-year low in the first half of 2014. Through June, Part 1 crime has been down over 31%. And the police are attributing that reduction, which includes both bus and rail, to multiple factors: increased customer awareness and outreach, data-driven officer deployment tactics through our MetroStat meetings, which are held on a regular basis, improvements in technology, and intelligence sharing between law enforcement partners. And some numbers related to that: snatch theft of mobile devices down 49%, bicycle theft down 35%, and robberies down 43%. One number has slightly ticked up during the quarter, and that's crime in the parking lots and garages. Okay, customer satisfaction. So all these measures I just talked about impact this very important measure about how satisfied our customers are. On both bus and rail, satisfaction results are below target and worse than the same period last year for the quarter. But overall, if you look at the trend, it's showing stability on rail and some modest improvements on bus. Our folks in customer research delve into this data and conclude that in the warmer months of the spring quarter, again, April, May, and June, we have a greater proportion of customers riding the system who are what we call occasional riders, tourists. And these customers, when you talk to them, often score their experience, their riding experience, highly. But that positive result is sometimes offset by a more decrease in satisfaction of regular customers as the two types of customers kind of mix together on the system. And our regular riders are impacted by an influx of occasional riders who have different habits as they ride the system, if I will. They're not as familiar with the system. But we do love to have our visitors. So overall, Metro bus satisfaction rating this quarter is really not statistically different from a prior period, so it's stable. Metro rail satisfaction moved in a positive direction, so in October to December it was at 76%, and for the last couple of quarters it's been at 80%. That continued emphasis, as I said, on delivering reliable and safe transit service will continue to move our satisfaction ratings in the right direction. And now moving to the final slide, coming attractions. The reporting period, we hadn't actually opened the Silver Line yet, so the next vital signs report in a couple of months in November will include some of the results from Silver Line Phase 1 after it opened. And that is the vital signs report for the quarter.
Thank you very much. Can I answer any questions? I think I'll ask you to just go back and share with us, the board, the description of lowering the elevator repair time. Would you just speak to the fact of the process of how this is being done, how it's been so effective in doing so?
Well, I think it's, we use the kind of terminology, getting it right the first time. Mm-hmm. So as we do the repairs and as we replace units and rehabilitate units, basically when they do break down, they can be repaired much faster. 5 hours as compared to 17 hours 2 years ago. So all this continued investment of time and energy and better management.
Right. I think what adds to that is the preventive maintenance. As you recall, a few years ago, I think it was around 40-some percent of the preventive maintenance was done on time, and now we're up around 90-some percent. And going along with what Andrea said, it's not only doing it right the first time, but actually doing the preventive maintenance so that you have fewer breakdowns. And it's in better shape.
Tony,
Thank you for the report. Some very good improvements, and certainly I don't hear as a customer or as a resident complaints about escalators much anymore. Now it's cleanliness, so it goes back and forth, but that's an issue. But one of the questions I had to do with rail fleet reliability, and page 469 talked about the 4000 series rail cars and the door problems. When we complete our total replacement of the 1000 series cars, is the next series cars we want to replace the 4000?
Yes, we've already exercised the options for that in the 7K contract.
And in the interim, is there anything we can do about the doors, or is it any rehab being scheduled, or is it just something we have to kind of keep an eye on?
As I recall, our car engineering group is looking at the causes of this and trying to come up with solutions, but We haven't found one yet that really solves the problem.
And who was the manufacturer of the 4,000, sir?
Oh, I don't remember offhand.
That wasn't Brito, was it?
I don't remember.
No, it's Kraft. Okay. It's the Spanish for us.
Okay. All right. The lemon, okay. Is that like a lemon tree, Tom? Lemon tree?
Spanish lemon.
Oh, okay. All right.
Spanish.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Bolger and then Mr. Dam.
Yes, this is very important. How do we tackle
these customers? Thanks, Tony. You know, Andrew says we got the tourists and the occasional riders mingled with the regular riders. Do we need to do some kind of initiative for the tourists? I mean, I don't know how to tackle that, but you know, you read on greater Washington, there's about stand to the right, all that stuff. I don't know.
You just put your finger right on it. Frequent and infrequent riders have different expectations. Infrequent riders have their own culture on the system and their own norms about noise, about how they travel through a station, about the expectations they have for crowd flow, and when folks who are not familiar with the system are there with bags and strollers and are, particularly in the rush hour, interrupting that crowd flow or having a what you and I would consider to be a normal volume conversation but in the middle of a quiet, otherwise quiet car, those kinds of things create dissonance between the culture of frequent riders and infrequent riders. I will tell you that Metro in Washington is not alone in this regard. I remember in the New York metropolitan region, and I'm sure Mort will vouch for me on this, on Wednesdays they have this problem. Rich will know this. It's a Broadway matinee day. And on Wednesdays, all kinds of folks ride the trains into the city from the matinees who are not frequent riders, and they go in groups and they have conversations and they bring lunch and they come back with shopping bags, lots and lots of shopping bags, and the regular riders are always unhappy on Wednesdays. So I say that I've seen this in different places. Some of it's sort of human psychology and cultural behavior, and some of it works itself out. Stand to the right is probably the most frequently heard complaint during the high tourist season, is that people don't understand. Because for our frequent riders, and frankly, I think this is traffic calming on Metro. I don't want folks running up and down the escalators. That is one of the biggest sources of our customer injuries, right? So preventing that is not a bad thing, necessarily. But if you're a frequent rider and you have, and our customers really do have their own habits of how they're going to go down, where they're going to board, where they're going to alight. They have a car they want to stand or sit in because that's where they're going to get up. They have their whole zone that they're in. And anything that interrupts that zone is going to decline satisfaction with their experience on the system. And so the nature of our business is such that we have to accommodate everybody. From time to time, we do etiquette campaigns. In fact, the general manager blogged on this week. To try to remind people of certain courtesies that they should afford each other. And that's sometimes helpful in terms of reminding folks what the standard of the custom of our region is. But you can't micromanage this to a successful end.
I have an idea. If we ever get to automatic train control, okay, then if you take the BART experience, people line up where that door is going to open. Okay, so they know that the train will stop within a two-door space. And I think we saw a thing recently, Rich, where I think it was Lynn or maybe Andrea, about how people crowd into certain cars and then leave the front car and sometimes the back car, with a lot of space. Mm-hmm. So is there sometime in the near future we get the automatic train control, which may alleviate some of this crush on the platforms?
No.
No.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. Today we are very strict about where train operators have to stop, car marker. In fact, you'll notice it sometimes, and it's maybe maddening to a customer, sometimes it's to me, they'll be off by 3 feet and they're stopped. They will not open the doors. They'll move it up that 3 feet, which is what they should do. So that today, those door openings line up the same place every time. Unfortunately, with the new 7 case coming on board, for structural reasons and safety reasons, those doors have moved a little bit, the end doors. So, in fact, it won't line up precisely the same as the older fleet. Automatic train operation won't have anything to do with it.
Mr. Downs, I'm sorry, and then we can go around. Thank you.
Volumes that we had anticipated, and that work always counts as part of our performance indicator about escalator availability. Not recognizing that in the performance means that as we work really hard to catch up on escalator maintenance and replacement, escalator overhaul and replacement, those escalator availability numbers are going to inevitably go down. I think it's better to try and quantify a bit the impact of the work on escalator availability. We all acknowledge that it has to go on if you're taking escalators out of service to either replace them or overhaul them. And just having that as a recognized fact about the way the numbers are structured makes it explainable if we have a valid way of work going forward about the escalator availability. The two things about, I just want to make two quick points about customer satisfaction. The statistics in the attachments to the report on Metro Rail customer satisfaction shows that rail satisfaction for this year in January and March was 80% street tourists. But the customer satisfaction for April, June
is still 80%.
80% for this year. Previous year in 13 for January and March was 84% customer satisfaction. And in April and June, for 86%.
Something else is going on, and I look forward to the detailed customer satisfaction survey data that fills out part of the meaning of this. The other is that a Metrobus, January, March of last year, 82% customer satisfaction, this year, 78%. April and June of last year, it was 82%. This year, it's 80%. The trend line isn't exactly what I think we'd all like to see. And I know a quarter is not, I hate things that are just driven by quarterly performance, but long-term trend analysis and long-term work programs that address the real customer satisfaction that we find through the survey work is really important for the board to understand this critical criteria on customer satisfaction. Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Hines and then Mr. Downey.
Thanks. I want to return to the issue of our two kinds of riders, our regular riders and our occasional riders, and especially occasional riders who visit our region for whatever reason. And I'm asking because I don't know whether we currently work with our travel and tourism bureaus in the region and or the hotel community to sort of transmit those etiquette and, you know, have a successful experience messages, and then secondly, whether we've thought about, as we roll out this new convention pass, whether there's additional information that we can gather because we're in these relationships in a long, ongoing way.
It's an excellent point. We do have relationships with the Convention and Visitors Bureaus. In fact, we participate on the board level with some of them. We do disseminate information. I don't think in recent years we've done anything really about etiquette or customs, and we could certainly do that. And I think the convention pass is a great opportunity to get that information out to people. Historically, it's been more focused around, you know, map information, fare information, that kind of thing. Sort of the 1, 2, 3s of how to use the system. But adding that piece is a nice idea.
Mr. Vail.
Thank you. Two quick fact questions relating to this slide. On the 4,000 series cars, are they deployed throughout the system or are they concentrated? But everybody's sharing a pain on that. Okay. And then the Operations Control Center retention comment on that slide, what's that phenomenon?
Yeah. The issue is that we've had a lot of turnover in the Operations Control Center because we're competing with a lot of the other offices within Metro. And so what we're doing is we're working with labor and HR to find ways to retain our staff longer. So that's basically.
So when they pick that job, they have to stay in it a longer period of time.
Yes, that's what we're working towards, giving them some incentives to remain in the job longer than. Right now, there is no requirement to remain in the job longer than 1 year. So we're trying to find some incentives to get them to do that.
Thank you. My other concern, pretty much the same as Mr. Downs. It's very frustrating to see that the objective measures are improving and the customer satisfaction is not. Certainly don't come off of that and say, well, these stupid customers don't know what we're doing for them. We got to figure out why. And I really would encourage much more in-depth analysis, line by line, month by month. What are the factors that are creating this difference between what's actually happening and what's perceived? Because what's perceived is really what affects people's feelings about using the system.
Ms. Porter.
Well, I think when we're talking about customer satisfaction, I think we can be sure that one of the factors that's affecting it is some absolutely disastrous days we've had this year, particularly in the Red Line. And those have an outsized impact on what people's impression of the system is. Right. Well, I mean, just hearing people talk, I can tell you that one disastrous day on the Red Line affects people's perceptions for a very long time. And not just the people who were riding that day, but everybody they went home and complained to, and every one of their friends who had to hear about, you know, why they didn't make it to the whatever. You know, one thing like that can have a very large impact across, you know, all of our customers.
I was about to say, on the point of that, I think one of the things that we just talked about, the participation plan, sounds like a very good place for that, because that's how we're going to get to the customer to try and deal with that. It is not going to change the actual of delays and the like, but how much we can talk to people about the how we operate and what happens.
I look forward to coming back to the committee with the deeper dive information. We are out at bus stops talking to people about their perceptions about buses bypassing them, for example. We are talking to rail customers through research about their level of satisfaction and what drives it against better reliability numbers, for example. And so when we have better information, we'll return and present it. As one board member pointed out, a couple of quarters doesn't give you enough to really drill down on. So we look at that longer trend data and try to figure out where the disconnects are. To be sure, there are a few bad days, but that's not different from prior years. And in fact, there are few bad days than previously.
It seemed particularly bad on the Red Line this year.
As a red line writer, I can appreciate what you're saying. But when we look at the data, things are getting better. So we, if like me, you've been riding since the 80s on the red line, off and on, the effect, to your point, is cumulative. And it's hard to disaggregate for a customer their experience over time. So even an improvement doesn't show up in the survey research for quite a while.
Mr. Goldman, you have your story.
Good morning, Ms. Burnside. This is the topic that I wanted to talk about. The red, drill down a little bit on the red line. The red line is obviously one of the main streets in Montgomery County, at least north-south main streets. So the poor on-time performance that you flagged for the last quarter and the perception about it is a big concern both for members, because we get complaints, as well as elected officials in the county. For the last quarter, I think you flagged the problems with performance, one-time performance. Was the performance on the red line the worst in the system for that quarter?
I believe that's the case, yeah.
And since you've looked at these quarterly numbers now for a number of quarters, could you give us a longer view? Is the red line consistently the worst, or does it share that distinction with something else and flipping on quarters? Or, you know, sort of how do you rank the red line compared to the average and the other lines?
The red line does tend to drag down the overall on-time performance for the system, yes.
It's because it's the oldest line.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to. I wanted to talk through the reasons.
Right. So it's the oldest line. It's been the subject of great investment in infrastructure improvement. There has been, out of necessity, track work going on there out of a major initiative as part of our Metro Forward program for the last couple of years. And so things will get better as those investments pay dividends, but the disruption to the customer is also significant by virtue of the improvements that we're making.
I just want to add that the, as I recall, Andrea, the disruptions due to right-of-way has decreased.
Yes.
Over the last few years, reflecting the increased infrastructure investment. We're having difficulties with is the car reliability. We're trying to address that with campaigns with the existing fleet. And as you've heard me say before, I'll be very happy when the 7Ks come on and the 1Ks disappear and then the 4Ks disappear. The 1Ks in particular, not only are they the oldest part of the fleet, but we have to run them in mixed consists. We don't run 1Ks in the lead, so it's always mixed. And historically in this industry, when you mix fleets, even though they're supposed to be able to operate, you know, compatibly, inevitably because of the advances in technology, it's not quite perfect. So that just adds to the issue. So I'll be very pleased to see the oldest part of the fleet, the least reliable part of the fleet disappear. And that will help overall the system, but including a red line, which is very intense in terms of its service, to increase the on-time performance.
Will the introduction of the new cars help the red line performance directly, or is it
Yes, it'll help the red line as well as all lines that the 7Ks show up on. They, now we, oh, I forget, we're up over 400 that we're going to be buying.
Ms. Burnett, you indicated that the performance was better for July. Was that the result of some actions that were taken by staff and monitor, so programs being monitored that suggest that this is now a pattern of improvement quarterly, that it will get better?
I don't think 1 month makes a trend, but I think it's just the fact that we didn't have as many significant disruptions.
So it's the absence of these
right
episodic,
yes,
catastrophic events.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Bulger, last question.
I'm Chairman, I was remiss in mentioning this, but it's I noticed that the Washington metropolitan area is going to seek the Olympic bid, and I'm changing the subject from vital signs. And if that's the case, are we engaged in that adventure or initiative?
As recently as yesterday, I was talking to the Board of Trade. You know, Jim Dinegar is certainly one of the proposers of this and pushing it ahead, and we've had previous discussions on it. They're at a very early stage in this. However, one of the positives for seeking the bid is the metro system. And, you know, we certainly have issues and we have to work through it, But when you look at us compared to others, you know, it's a pretty nice system. And certainly that will be a ingredient in that. As they get closer and they go through the filtering process, you know, and I've been involved in this before in another location, we will become much more deeply involved in the planning for the Olympics and how we would transport people among the venues and that sort of thing.
Well, just so the board's aware of
Olympics. Having worked on three different sets of Olympics in terms of transportation, it's a make or break.
Yep.
First on whether it's a success. Go back to Atlanta. It was not a success, and it really caught them. It was the factor that brought the Olympics to London. The transportation proposal they put forth blew the International Olympic Committee out of the water in terms of what they were promised to do. And then the bad news is when you caught that truck, you got to deliver it. It's a very significant delivery thing. And then Salt Lake was kind of in the middle, easier to do the Winter Olympics. But transportation is the backbone of whether you're going to have a good set of games. And if there's to be a serious bid from this region, we have to be right at the front end of it.
Well, just keep us apprised of that, would you, Rich? I think there's a lot of interest, and many of us know the people who got named at a committee, and I'm sure we'll be asked privately what we're going to be doing. Like former Mayor Williams is a close colleague of mine, and he's on the committee, and I just don't want to, Madam Chair, you know, not have an answer when we get asked privately or publicly of where is Metro on this bid.
As I said, I've already personally offered a couple times. We stand ready to help them as soon as they get further advanced in their planning. It's very important. I know that.
Your question. Well, I was about to ask the let's kind of bring the discussion back. I think I was about to ask, are we ready for the World Games, which is more immediate than the Olympics in their life.
As you know, the World Games brings law enforcement agencies mm-hmm. together and is being held in Fairfax County
in the region,
but there's a lot of venues
the
in
venues
Fairfax County. And I want to say it's next summer.
It's July.
Okay. So our police chief has been working with his peers in the organizing committee around the events and activities. And we have talked to them about marketing and logistics support for this. And so we continue to be part of the planning committee. And we've also talked to them about some special fair media that they would use to promote transit travel to the various venues throughout the region.
Yeah, it is a substantial number of people, about 50, nearly 50 or 75% of an Olympic game. So that's still a large number of folks that do that.
Yeah, in fact, more people than they had at the London Olympics.
That's exactly right. Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Burnside. Let's move to the next item, and this is the quarterly update on the new electronic payments program. And Mr. Randall is going to provide the presentation.
Okay, thank you, and good morning. My name is Tom Randall, Director of Fair Payments, and I'm pleased to
be here. Can you raise your voice just a bit?
Sure.
Thank you.
My name is Tom Randall, and I'm here to provide an update on the new electronic payments program, or the NEP. I'll review the progress being made to launch the pilot phase, including selection of pilot stations, preparations for installation of new technology, participant recruitment, and other ongoing items. For the pilot mezzanines, 10 stations were selected for the pilot phase, where one pilot gate will be installed in each station. For stations with multiple mezzanines, such as Gallery Place, pilot program participants will be instructed on which mezzanines to use. Selection process began over 18 months ago and involved many stakeholders to address the operational and functional needs of the pilot phase. The primary considerations in selection was the volume of entry-exit pairings by customers necessary to achieve the pilot transaction objectives. We sought locations where riders could transfer to the pilot bus routes and pilot parking locations, and where the impact on customers not participating in the pilot could be minimized. We chose stations distributed through the entire region, every rail line is represented in the pilot, and where other Metro Rail projects that are underway or planned for the pilot period would not be impacted. This is an example of how the new gates may look alongside the current devices. In this picture, the new gates were added as station space was available. Some situations will require replacement of existing gates. And in all cases, the customer traffic flow was analyzed to minimize the impact on existing customers, ensure emergency exit capacity was sufficient. We're also exploring options for signage in the stations, such as floor decals leading up to the new gates, to better inform the new customers as well as the pilot participants that the new gates are not for general use. Selection of the pilot bus routes was conducted through a process similar to the Metro Rail stations as far as linking trips to the rest of the pilot phase transit points. A dedicated fleet was needed to provide the pilot customer expectations of utilizing the pilot systems. We're only implementing 50 devices on 50 buses, so that's why we needed the dedicated fleet for our customers. These routes were, of course, coordinated with the transfer points at the selection pilot phase rail stations. And DC area, we chose routes 37X9 and 39. 37 and 39, you see, will provide a transfer at Farragut West, and the X9 will transfer at Gallery. In Maryland, the K9 and J4 were selected. Route J4 transfers at the Bethesda Station, one of our pilot locations. And in Virginia, the Richmond Highway Express route was selected. Riders can transfer at the Eisenhower Avenue Rail Station, where pilot gates will be located. Also bringing up the point, we tried to organize the bus routes around common bus garages so we can provide proper maintenance and attention to the pilot devices as well. This is an example of this next slide of potentially what the pilot devices will look like. Got some better pictures now. Consistency in placement for the customer expectations, convenience, and bus operations is important, as well as ongoing maintenance and are some of the attributes that will be reviewed during the pilot. Two parking garages were selected, one at Shady Grove and one at Suitland, again linking the pilot phase rail stations. And this is a picture. We'll integrate the new reader into the existing payment station, and this will leave a separate smart trip device available for non-pilot customers. The new device will be distinctly labeled so customers won't be confused. And the pilot participant recruitment. After the initial public communication of the new program, and happening now, the specific recruitment will be done using marketing promotions, a sample of registered smart trip customers, and recruitment intercepts by teams of employees at bus stations, bus stops, and rail stations. A recruitment website is being developed with an application survey that will be used to select participants. And the goal is to recruit more applicants than needed participants to allow for sampling of the customers to best meet the pilot phase goals and the parameters. Final pilot sample will be a pool of around 3,000 participants. While a pool of about 3,000 applicants will be recruited, the goal of 2,000 participants fully complying with pilot parameters is our desire. Recruitment effort then is to recruit participants who meet a broad range of demographic and geographic and other criteria. And the overall pool will be sampled based on questionnaires completed in the application process to achieve a diversity of participants which is as close as possible reflects our overall customer base. We also plan to utilize some other select groups, such as our Accessibility Advisory Council and the Riders Advisory Council, for specific feedback as participants in the pilot program. The pilot timeline is moving forward to the scheduled start. Customers will begin to see devices on buses and in station mezzanines in October and November. and the pilot start date remains early January 2015. As I noted in my June presentation, the retail presence will expand greatly to service those customers who don't regularly use the internet or other means to add value to their cards or other media. Currently, there are about 260 locations available, and initially we'd expect to double those locations to at least 500. I'm providing a visual representation of how we'll cover a greater, larger geographic area here. Stores such as 7-Eleven, Family Dollar, Sunoco will be included, and additional locations not part of larger chains can be included if they have access to a website. So we'll be doing recruitment in specific areas where that is needed. Now, the expanded retail network is not a component of the pilot phase, but we're already developing plans to increase the locations where customers can purchase new fare media and add value before the full rollout. The overall timetable remains the same, with the initial full implementation transition to begin on buses, parking locations, and a select number of gates at each rail station in the spring of 2017. As you can see from the phased deployment, expanding the new system gates at the rail station occurs over multiple years as we transition smart trip usage to the new system. We're exploring opportunities to accelerate the overall deployment and achieve system benefits earlier. And again, while the pilot phase objectives are mostly technical in nature, ensuring the technical aspects work as they are expected to, all systems and processes will be tested thoroughly and completely prior to full deployment rollout. And that's my update for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Randall. We're going to come back before rollout time, the pilot, in December. And I assume the communication starts so that the larger public gets a very larger users get a greater understanding of what this looks like.
Very much so. Thank you.
Okay. Question, let me start with Mr. Downs.
The Apple announcement of the Apple Wallet yesterday about all of their cell phones going forward will have a bank pay capacity. And not only their cell phones, but the Apple Watch will have the same pay capacity. And a blog about on the Wall Street Journal about this actually is the starting gun for the race, the winner-take-all race about electronic payments in North America, at least. I hope that the testing process includes the new technologies just now hitting the marketplace of. They're selling these things today, and it would be nice if this capacity is part of the integrated test.
Well, I think that's a very important point. 2017, they probably will have many, many more.
So hundreds of millions more.
We will have to continuously keep up with that in that testing phase. Yep. Mr. Bolger, you have.
Yeah, I was just wondering if any of my colleagues want to volunteer to be in the pilot.
I'm sure, Mr. Bolger. We would.
I think the chair should be.
I'd try to get my phone.
Yeah. I think the chairman, at minimum, should be included in the pilot.
If he's in the right trip pairs, it makes sense.
We can still volunteer later.
Yeah. Madam Chair, we would definitely are reaching out to special groups, and we would appreciate specific input from this group as well.
6+.
Okay. Ms. Hines.
We're all looking forward to this. I want to ask the question about how conversations are going with our other partners, because we all want this to be a regional-wide thing that works really well. So can you update us on those conversations with the other bus companies in the region?
Certainly, Madam Chair, committee members, we have had several meetings, and a number of meetings since our last update here, and they're progressing well. We had a face-to-face meeting just a week or so ago, and teleconferences since then. We outlined a process to move forward both with our integrator and with WMATA personnel linking those aspects together so we would travel along this path together so they would understand where WMATA was headed, how fast, or where Metro was headed, that type of thing. We initially put together a list of about 7 committees to put together and heard back quickly, boy, that's too many for us to manage. So we pared it down to key areas of which the participation seemed to be doable as well. And we're proceeding to develop meetings and conversations along those lines, meeting the specifications requirements for each of the groups, how that can be related and leveraged off of what the Metro contract already contains as well, so we'll gain all those efficiencies there. And then discussing other aspects of customer usage, especially retail locations, are a high priority for a number of those groups as well. So we're maintaining contact. Everybody's looking to see what they can do next and how it fits in. So it's still preliminary stages, but I think we've started to get some real momentum together.
That's good. I obviously, we are all concerned at the local level about the cost, given all the layering of costs that's associated with Metro 2025 and momentum and, you know, all of that. So I would hope that as soon as possible, some of the thinking around cost to the localities can also start to surface.
Definitely, Madam Chair, committee members. We're looking at that's the first part of the specifications requirements. Then they'll work with the integrator to develop those specific costs. Again, the device costs are the same as what is in the existing agreement. And if we can leverage any of the integration aspects, that would help out in that way as well. Some groups have formed Alliance Northern Virginia to go forth as a larger group and leverage their program management capacities, those types of things. So we're aware of that, and if we weren't, we would be aware of it every time we speak to the regional providers. Definitely.
Thank you.
Mr. Giancarlo.
Just a reflection, when I came on the board in spring of 2007, in the fall of that year, we formed a technology subcommittee and started talking about this. So 2015, that's 8 years to fruition. So just some reflection with Jeff McKay, who was the Virginia rep, Peter Benjamin from Maryland, and myself were talking about this back then.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Goldman.
Mr. Randall, just to thumb this down, so I always feel I have to make sure I ask the questions to understand where this is going. For the pilot that starts in June, I assume the basic device is going to be a smartphone that people will use to access the system in the pilot.
Madam Chair, Ms. Committee members. We'll start in January. I'm sure in January is when the pilot starts.
Okay.
And then it's actually finishing in June of 2015. So we'll be using a variety of fare media. Smartphones are included, as well as our contactless payment cards. Contactless credit or debit cards are included, and other devices that we know of or that we can develop with, Apple iPhone being one of them, that we can integrate into our system. So a multitude of media will be included.
So for a credit card, someone would have to have the chip in the card for that kind of credit card to work. Is that right, or will any credit card work during the pilot?
Madam Chair, committee members, that is a very good question because we get that a lot, and there can be confusion because some of the security standards coming forth now require a chip. EMV is the technical term for that. That's a security aspect. So to be usable on our system, it requires the near-field communication chip, which is somewhat different than the other security chip in the phone. So it has to be the right kind of chip as well.
Are there any cards out there in the U.S. now that have those chips in there?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes. Yes, there are. Not as widespread as we'd like to see now. We expect that to grow. And I think last time I was with him, Dan Steffel had one in his pocket, I think.
Tell us what that looks like. Now, turning to the smartphones. Is the test limited to certain smartphones, or will any Android phone, any Apple phone, picking up on Chairman Down's question, will the iPhone 6 as well as the 5 be eligible to participate in the test, in the pilot?
Madam Chair, committee members, The smartphones that are exist today, they've existed about 3 years on an Android platform or so with the NFC chip. We're testing all those versions. We're not familiar so much, as is anybody else, with the iPhone 6 yet, but we've reached out to Apple and others so we can be accustomed to it. And a few of us will be up at 3 in the morning ordering them so we can test them out as best we can. So we're working on those as well. But for the most part, the standard device, the industry standard that we're building this open platform for, is widespread and accommodates many, many devices in the system today.
So you would expect that people who buy the iPhone 6 would be able to participate in the pilot, or you're not sure about that as yet?
We're still looking at that technology. We certainly hope that we are able to test those devices in the pilot, and we'll work towards that end, definitely. It's just a timing thing, whether those people test it or whether we have a control group within our own environment. But that's definitely what we're working for.
All right. Mm-hmm. Final question. During the test, the way the system will work, by analogy, let me dumb it down to what I know that works for me is the Starbucks app. Mm-hmm. And flash the Starbucks when you buy your morning latte. Is that basically how the system is going to work, that you'll download an app and you'll be able to load the app with your additional dollars on your smartphone and then put it into the reader as you go through the turnstile?
Madam Chair, committee members, that could be one way to utilize it. Another way would be with a card, say a contactless credit card now with that NFC technology. There really wouldn't be any application to download, but it would recognize the unique ID of that card, and especially if you registered it, it would take the payment, or you could register it and have an ongoing travel with it as well. So a little mix of technology there.
Mm-hmm. But the technology that will work for the smartphone is that there will be an app that you will have to download, are you limited to going onto a website to load your smartphone with your week's worth of money?
Oh, Madam Chair, no, you won't have to go back to the website to download. All our aspects will be mobile and other ways to load value to your phone or your other media.
So it basically function like the Starbucks app.
Yes.
For Metro, yes.
Yeah.
Coffee.
Right. I would just say that it's a smart chip rather than the reader that is used, or the barcode that's used at Starbucks. So that's a very big difference.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That explains a little better to me, and hopefully the public as well.
Good.
Thank you very much. We look forward to this coming back in December, and we most importantly look forward to January to start seeing the reaction to it.
You
well.
Too.
Thank you very much. Any other items to come before? Hearing none, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.